This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz Podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dan Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. How's it going, Dane?
Great, Andy. How are you today?
I'm good.
Happy New Year to you.
And also Hugh Syme, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Andrew. And yes, it is so nice to get 21 behind us.
Yes, absolutely. And this is our one-year anniversary episode. Hard to believe in some ways. It went really, really fast. It's been a great year. We had the opportunity to talk to, you know, some friends, reconnect with people, talk to some heroes along the way. And I think, you know, to kick this one-year anniversary off, I think it's kind of maybe a good idea to point out the obvious. The whole reason for the podcast is, A, the three of us like to talk and like to talk to each other and like to talk to other people and get stories. It really comes down to stories. And a lot of the people that we talk to on this show are people that were there. Maybe not the most well-known person in a band or in the industry, but somebody that was there. Literally a fly on the wall, or still is a fly on the wall, as the three of us are and have been throughout our career. So Music Buzz Podcast was really kind of hatched from that idea. And honestly, it's exceeded my expectations. I don't know about you guys. You know, we come out every 2 weeks and we continue to chart with this podcast all over the world. You know, we see, gosh, I was looking the other day, not just the US and Canada, but consistently charting in Brazil and the Netherlands and the UK, amongst others, many others. And so Israel, it's been interesting to see people listening all over the world. And so I think it all comes down to people like stories.
But are we big in Japan?
But everybody's big in Japan.
That's actually a good question, because I don't think we are big in Japan. We need to work
on that. Great song. It's a great song too. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we need to work on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So happy new year to you guys, and looking forward to season two. So I'll kick it over to you, Dane. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's 2022. Gosh, John Mellencamp's record that I played on this past year will be, the whole record will be released. Strictly a One-Eyed Jack is the title of that. And of course, the Wasted Days single came out a few months ago with Bruce Springsteen. That was quite a high point to have a song that I was involved in and played on, and that the boss came along and did his part on, and he's on quite a few other songs on the record too. So
right. Well, it's been highly publicized that John and Bruce are buddies. What was that experience like for you? I mean, obviously many years of working with John and whatnot, but what was that like?
Unfortunately, the way things ended up being, we had cut all the tracks, and Bruce actually came in a few months later, towards the mixing time. So I didn't actually get to go down and hang out or with him, but I have met him before during the Vote for Change tour back in 2005. He was a really nice guy.
Right.
But he came and hung with John and was sighted by several people in Bloomington, I think, walking around. Mm-hmm. And he played. There's a cut that I'm not going to mention any until the record comes out. Don't want to screw the pooch, but there's a song he plays a lead guitar solo on that it gets back to the bar band days of the early Springsteen thing, and it's really cool. It's really raw, and that's going to be a fun track. So I think people are going to enjoy this record.
You know, when I started my career with Sunshine Promotions back in the glory days, some of my first few shows were at the Fieldhouse in downtown Indy at the time, which had just opened, because, you know, Market Square Arena, the last few shows at Market Square were that year. And then Springsteen was the first show at the Fieldhouse. And then, of course, that New Year's Eve, you guys played.
We played.
Mellencamp played New Year's Eve, heading into Y2K.
Yeah, and, that's right.
Gosh, you know, that's been a long time ago, but still, Springsteen, man, just still one of the most spontaneous live performers, you know, ever. And still, it's amazing that a guy can still do what he does for 3.5 hours a night when he's out
there. I know.
It's incredible.
He's got an incredible amount of energy. I saw Bruce in 78 on the Darkness on the Edge of Town. That's the name of the album, I believe, right? The one that came out then.
Mm-hmm.
The record had just hit the stores, and I remember buying a couple tickets, and me and my buddy went, and it was at the convention center. And what I remember about it the most was I was 18, and you know, what I remember is at the end of the show, he got a bunch of strippers from the Red Garter to come over and dance on the last song. Now, there wasn't a teenage guy there that wasn't enjoying that. Let me just tell you, that was quite a spectacle.
What's the Red Garter? I don't know what that is.
Well, it's a gentleman's club. I don't know if it was a French place, the Red Garter. I'm not sure that it's still there. And I had never, you know, I mean, when I was 17 or 18, I looked like I was about 12, so I wouldn't have gotten in back then.
Right.
Did you ever drum for exotic dancers? Dane?
No, it's something I've always aspired to, though. It's not, I'm not saying that I still wouldn't, you know.
Still a career goal, huh?
You actually have?
Yeah, there was a friend of mine in Toronto who got sick for a few days, and he drummed at a fairly well-known place in Toronto called the Zanzibar. So I had no clue what the, you know, the set list was and so on. So I just winged it, but it was fun. You know, I was quite motivated standing in the rear, so to speak. Yeah, it was a new experience.
So was it a whole band playing for them?
So, yeah, it was a 4-piece band. Yeah.
Was it, were you going, you know, were you playing da, 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 that kind of stuff? Or
we didn't do the
stripper song. Rose.
Quite frankly, a lot of jamming, just, you know, just as long as it had a good pocket and gave room for movement.
Do you remember any of the ladies' names?
One of the girls I did use on an album cover. It was a disco, a very, you know, I don't even remember the name of it.
Oh.
I mean, it was for CBS Records.
Well, speaking of covers, I know that Hugh has worked on some covers as a result of the podcast this year that have come out. I know Rivers and Rust project Kyle Cook put out.
Yeah, it was great working with Kyle. It was a great title too. You know, it was called "What a Waste."
Mm-hmm.
I respond well to good titles, and you know, I've been spoiled by quite a few bands, notably Rush, who never failed to have a great title.
Right.
Sometimes you don't even have to listen to the music; you just know it's, you know.
Well,
it's a great image.
You sure came up with a winner for my upcoming record that's going to come out. Which still may
Thanks,
be full.
Man.
Yeah, I'm still trying to decide if it's just going to be an EP or a full album. But Memory Mile.
That's the project with Donovan and John Sebastian.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yep.
Tell us more about that.
Maybe. Yeah, well, you know, Donovan toured with the Mellencamp band in, I'm thinking it was 2005. And interestingly, instead of being the opening act, we played an opening thing, and then we played Donovan's part, which was about 45 minutes or 50, and then John came back on and finished the show. So it was, we've never done anything like that before or since. It was pretty unusual.
Interesting.
For the quote unquote opening act to be in the, right in the middle of the show. But it kind of made sense the way, you know, the way John organized it. It was really cool.
Was that a John decision, like something
he was
to, okay. That's
yeah,
cool.
He wanted it to be that way. And I think maybe he wanted to come out and watch Donovan play a lot, you know, during the thing. And, you know, what a treat for us. I mean, we played, you know, all the hits, Sunshine Superman, Mellow Yellow, Hurdy Gurdy Man, Catch the Wind.
It's too bad that some bands don't, or acts don't do more of that kind of thing. I remember there was that several tours that the members from the Grateful Dead did with Bob Dylan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over the years. And there was actually one of my favorite memories of anybody asked me about memories about the Grateful Dead or Bob Dylan. I've got several memories, but there was, it was after Jerry died and the members of the Dead were out touring, whatever configuration, whatever they were calling themselves at the time, with Dylan. And Charlie Rose was following them around doing a piece for 60 Minutes at the time. Hmm. And Charlie was, and his whole crew was in town. And I had to address them on what the rules were for the venue, you know, corporate policies and the whatever. And they weren't allowed to record anything in Shakedown Street, which is out in the parking lots of those shows, you know, and
right.
various cheese sandwiches and other things going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember going out there and stopping the filming because they went out there and filmed anyway, unbeknownst to me. And I stepped in front of Charlie and he gave me this look like, I'm going to kill you and cut your head off, you know. How dare you? Later that night, he kept looking at me all day, like, you know, you shouldn't have done that kind of thing. I was just doing my job. And later that night, he came up to me and like tapped me on the shoulder. Go, hey, I just want you to know that I respect what you did. And I'm like, oh, thanks, man. He goes, hey, if you want to come in the dressing room, we're going to sit down and talk to the guys from the Dead and Dylan, if you want to come in. And so I went in there. It was just those guys and Charlie and the cameraman and me sitting there.
Wow.
Well, he interviewed them and Bob didn't say a word to anything. He just kind of chuckled the whole time.
I saw Dylan actually open for Phil Lesh and friends. Was that what it was?
No, it was okay. Whatever it was. Now they call it, you know, now they're called, you know, Dead and Company, but it, right. it was just called the Dead at that time, like Dylan and the Dead okay. or something like that.
Huh,
and at okay. one point, they were called the Other Ones. They've had various configurations right. names, but I don't remember. But
well, I'm going to tell my story now because I went to see the Phil Lesh and Friends Dylan show, right? So I went with a couple high school friends, and I believe Bob Kevoian gave me the tickets he had. And he said, I'm not going to go. Do you want to go? He called me. And I said, yeah, man, thank you. I appreciate it. So we didn't bother to get there until after Phil Lesh. I wasn't sure what Phil Lesh was going to do, but he really is not a singer. And, you know, I wasn't that hip on having to see that. I just wanted to see Bob, right? So I just remember getting to the show. We're sitting in our seats and we're sitting there for a while and I'm going, man, that's a weird looking stage setup for Dylan, you know, because it was in between the acts. And then somebody like a few minutes later turned around and said, yeah, man, I'm sure glad Dylan's done. Now we can watch Phil Lesh. And I said, what? Bob Dylan's opening up for Phil Lesh?
Yeah.
Which I found really odd. And so we missed it.
Oh,
and,
shoot.
I miss Bob.
Right. We've definitely had the opportunity to talk to a lot of really cool people over the last year. It's been fun. I mean, for sure. And looking forward to what's ahead. I don't know. Who are a few of your favorites that you guys had the opportunity to talk to, if you don't mind sharing?
Chris Hillman, for me,
yeah.
being the bird, BYRD, NYRD that I am.
Right.
Yeah.
That was definitely, hands down, my favorite conversation. He sure loved me that day. He was going, he was digging me.
Yeah.
But no, that was, I mean, you know, everybody that we've had has been interesting.
I found Steve Hackett really fascinating. Having met years ago in L.A., it was just happened to be the neighbor of someone who did glass sandblasting of glass for me for creating dimensional logos. This is all well before Photoshop. His neighbor across the road was Van Dyke Parks. And
yeah,
I remember him coming to the door and thinking, wow, this man wrote Smiley Smile with Brian. You know, I thought.
Surf's up, man.
Surf's up. And Good Vibrations, too. I mean.
Actually, he didn't write that. Mike Love wrote the words to that. That was already finished when he.
Okay. All right.
But still, that was a heavy one, too. When that thing he played on that piano, that grand piano that kind of sounded like a tack piano that he had, was unbelievable.
How many of our guests sit down and actually perform for us like that? That was pretty special.
I don't know. Maybe we ought to start seeing if they will, you know?
Yeah.
There's been a few. I mean, Van Dyke obviously did. And then I thought that, you know, the Holiday one was cool with Paul Gilbert because he pretty much talked to us through the guitar for half the episode, which was kind of entertaining.
Yeah. I had no way of expecting that by talking with Peter Frampton, whose covers were always pretty much him, which made sense because, you know, he's a great guitarist, good looking guy.
Yeah.
But as soon as we touched on artwork, I thought, well, this is going to be a brief discussion. He ended up deviating from that expectation by bringing out his father's, you know, treasured illustrations that he had done. I thought that was pretty special.
That was cool.
Actually, on camera, going,
yeah,
showing us what his father had drawn, and very capably too. Beautiful work.
Yeah, I enjoyed a bunch of them. All of them, really. Nils Lofgren was a highlight for me. Just, I'm such a huge fan of Springsteen, obviously, but also Neil Young. And that, I don't know if you guys have heard the new Neil Young and Crazy Horse album, and Nils is in Crazy Horse again.
Yeah, bits and pieces of it. It's
called,
great.
It's called Barn, and it's honestly, it's one of the best, probably in my opinion, the best Crazy Horse album since Ragged Glory. And that's a lot, you know. I mean, it's really, really a special record. You need to listen to it for sure.
And it's always nice to speak with friends. When Larry came on, I actually felt guilty for the old home week nature of our call, because he and I were just kind of catching up, you know. It was great, though. I have huge respect for him.
That's wonderful, man.
Yeah, no, it was great. I have huge respect for him as a performer. I've known him since the Gaswork days, which incidentally is where I first met Steve Hackett, who happened to have an evening off and came to see the band that I used to play with. The Gaswork is where Rush cut their teeth, Max Webster. Any band in Toronto would have played at the Gasworks. And seeing Larry performing this epic project of his, I won't say the title of it because it's now in the works. He's been working on this for a few years with Russ Mackey in Toronto as the producer. And they've got everybody from Todd in Styx playing on it. They've got Jerry Murata, Tony Levin. They've got an awful lot of good people playing on this project. And we've been developing the artwork for 4 years, so that's been fun. Certainly, the kind of pace I like when I work on artwork. It's pretty rare in the record industry having 4 years to play with. But there you have it.
The thing about Hugh, the thing about that I've noticed with the two things that you've done for me, the Moby Grape cover, which we've got our fingers and toes and eyes crossed that will come out this year.
Good.
The fantastic. I mean, that took you all of less than 24 hours. The Memory Mile EP /album, which will hopefully be out the beginning of March, is my hope for that, with Dane Clark and the Backroom Boys. That took you less than a day for that beautiful cover. I'm amazed by that. And by the way, I showed that to Elliot Murphy, loved it, and Donovan loved it too.
Well, that's gratifying to me, because living in England, as I did in the 60s, in those magic, you know, British invasion years, hearing Sunshine Superman, hearing Hurdy Gurdy and all those wonderful songs, and I was a big fan of his, not even knowing kind of why I liked his music, only to later find out who he played with and why his recording sounded so amazing, you know.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, he had Led Zeppelin on half his tunes, and, you know, Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones. And the crazy thing is, the song that we wrote, a song when I was talking earlier about that tour that we did back, gosh, it's been 15, 17 years ago now, I guess. We wrote a song during that tour. He had a song that somebody strummed a chord, and we were in a hotel room and he sang this thing. And I took it home and wrote the chord progression to it, and then I wrote the chorus to it. And it's actually going to see the light of day. It's the only song he's ever co-written with another person, ever.
Wow.
So
that's a privilege.
Privilege for me out this year. So it's been kind of sitting around getting cobwebs on it for a long time, and it's going to see the light of day. So,
you know, one topic that I notice comes up a lot, I think maybe goes overlooked, at least for me with you, Hugh, is you're known for the artwork stuff, and we focus so heavily on that, but the musician side of your life, having played on Rush albums and other things. But the one reference that you do make a lot is the band you played with, you know, back in the 70s on the same label as Rush, same management, etc., the Ian Thomas Band. I don't know much about the Ian Thomas Band, I'll be honest. I'd like to know more about, like, your involvement with that band, what you guys did, kind of what, you know, why it kind of, why you left the band. I'd love to know a little more about that, if you don't mind sharing.
Well, 75 through 81, I was with the band, and we recorded 6 albums that I was involved with, you know, and I was really required to pull up my socks. I mean, I was pretty good at what I did, but, you know, the people in the band already, Steve Hogg on bass, Michael Oberle on drums, and an extraordinarily gifted lead singer and writer, Ian Thomas, you know, who honestly had the most chameleon voice he used to do even for commercials, he would be called upon because he did the best dead ringer for the Beach Boys. He had an Art Garfunkel meets Harry Nilsson meets Paul McCartney kind of voice. The talent of the man didn't go unnoticed. He was covered by Santana, Chicago, America. They did cover a few of his songs. Nice. But I think, these guys were really good players and really good singers. It was a privilege and a real education for me to be in a band like that. But Ian heard me playing on a recording that I did when he was producing a folk duo called Crawford and Wickham. And he asked if I'd want to join his band. And I thought, well, that's not quite what I had in mind as I graduated from university. But I decided to go to the first rehearsal and so on, and it stuck. I mean, it was the first time I saw and played a mellotron, well before I played on Rush's things. So
there was a mellotron there. So you got to.
Yeah. Oh, this is the thing. This is back when record labels stood behind bands and would buy you a Fender Rhodes, a mellotron, a clavinet, an ARP synthesizer.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I walk in the room and suddenly I adopted all this gear. I thought, yeah, I could get used to this. It was Christmas morning, and then of course, never having played mellotron before, I took to it immediately, I really enjoyed the process. But the band itself, we had the good fortune of going out and playing, opening up for the Beach Boys for several dates. We went out with Robert Palmer, Billy Joel at Massey Hall, Roxy Music at Massey Hall. We did a tour. Who's the guy that did On the Border?
Was it Al Stewart?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we went on tour with Al Stewart, and we had a great time. We went right down through the middle of America down to Corpus Christi, and then we would come back to the humbling realization that we had to, earn a living and survive, and we would be back in the gasworks where it all kind of gestated in the first place.
Sure.
It was a great experience. But check out Ian's work. Definitely check out his work. And he went on to produce or create a band called the Boomers with Bill Dylan, Rick Grattan on drums, and Peter Cardinelli, phenomenal bass player. And this is just a 4-piece band, but they're wonderful as well. And they were huge in Hamburg and places like that. They were very well received there. But you'll see the talent of the man. I mean, it was a privilege to work with Ian and co-write a couple of things with him and certainly arrange things with him.
Yeah.
That was my favorite part of being in a band, was arrangement. And it still is. It's probably my favorite part of making music, is arranging.
Well, good arrangement will make or break you, that's for sure.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, obviously you're known for the Rush stuff and other works, but was there a time when you got a call about a project that you were like super fan of somebody and like, oh man, this is a great opportunity, and you were kind of nervous about it, even after you'd had so much experience and stuff?
My career, apart from being a workaholic and continue to be a workaholic, and I was very committed to doing, my best, I was driven to do the best I could for each project. I was working in Toronto predominantly, and Rush, of course, my own band, the Ian Thomas band, Max Webster, again, Kim Mitchell, remarkable guitarist and singer and songwriter. I worked with Max, did a very early cover for Unison for Celine Dion. I did the design for that project, so that was a little taste of the upper echelon and the growing upper echelon of musicians. But Spencer Proffer, producer from LA, who had just had some success in the 80s with Quiet Riot and Come On, Bang Your Head and Come On Hear the Noise, all that, he was working on a project for CBS Toronto called Kick Axe, and I was hired to do that, and he liked it. And when he came up to Toronto, I met him, and he invited me down to LA, which kind of began a whole new chapter of my life. I expected to stay for 6 weeks working on both the Quiet Riot album painting that I did, as well as another painting through meeting Spencer's ex-wife, Trudy Green, who was, she had a whole roster of artists of her own, later to be a manager for Bad English, at the time I met her, she was managing this guy called David Coverdale, and would I like to meet him at the Le Mondrian Hotel? And I did, and I went to David's room, and I, you know, he was a little concerned at the time about his voice because he'd had a little surgery done. And so I had the distinction of sitting in a chair and having him fire up the band track and sing to me. You know, I look back on it as an extraordinary, you know, privilege and opportunity to hear a guy with those kind of pipes singing right at you. And that led to me doing that cover, that sort of fateful cover for him. And then the call started coming in, you know, would you like to meet Meatloaf? Would you like to meet, you know, Billy Idol? And would you like to meet several bands, you know, that sort of came my way as a result of my staying busy and hopefully keeping my level of workmanship up. And it was at a time when the industry was on a roll, you know, everybody was paying attention to each other, you know. You know, getting a call from Bon Jovi wasn't lost on me. You know, getting a call from management for Aerosmith was also kind of, so every once in a while you'd hang the phone up and go, well, now this is a good sign, you know. Yeah. And that continued to be the nature of the career.
Well, I think to a certain extent that probably continues to this day. I mean, you know, even the Joe Bonamassa new record from this year, and obviously the Dream Theater stuff. I mean, I would imagine every time you kind of get a call or, you know, or whatever, it's exciting, right?
I'm hugely excited and grateful. I never presume, even during my long tenure with Rush, where, you know, you slowly kind of got the idea that you might kind of be their resident art director. I never presumed to be so, because I knew how big the world was and how much exposure they had to all kinds of, and they were all very astute in terms of collecting their own artwork. They knew good work. So staying loyal to me and I to them was always a lifelong, you know, privilege for me. But, you know, you also have bands today who are considerably younger, you know, who they didn't grow up with Rush, but they've discovered Rush and they appreciate the artwork in this new era, and they make their way back to you. So it's not like what you did then is lost on who some of these people are now. I worked with Barbora, lead singer for a band called Fairy Tale in Slovakia, and Gustavo Carmo, you know, remarkable guitarist. He just finished doing an album with Mohini on bass, and, you know, really, I mean, he's a stunning player and a really nice guy. Again, I didn't know who he was before he called me, and these opportunities are equally important to me. Not everybody has to be, you know, a band of notoriety, right, or with deep pockets. You know, it's sometimes nice to just give back to people who are excited to work with you, you know. Sure. And it's not about the, you know, and of course we've all adjusted our thinking about this industry that we used to thrive in, you know. I've used the phrase, we are feeding off the carcass of what used to be the music business. That's pretty prevalent for most people involved.
No, you know, question about that.
Not everybody manages to navigate their way from their bedroom to stardom like Billie Eilish did, you know. Yeah. And, you know, and then there are people who just kind of break through. The most unexpected, but extraordinarily talented people like Adele, you know, even Sia. You know, Sia is a quirky but super talented singer, you know, who just percolates in the background, only to find out later that she had written for Rihanna and Beyonce and all these people.
Right.
You don't know these things until you do the research, you know.
Yeah, kind of like Chris Stapleton, you know, he'd written a bunch of hit songs.
Mm-hmm. And the Bryant family with, you know, Felice and Budleigh Bryant, who wrote All I've Got to Do Is Dream and Love Hurts and all that. You know, these people are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool. Thank you for sharing.
Well, and, you know, and I want to also say that you do good work because that's just what you do. And if you find something that you believe in, yeah, you're going to make great art for it. It's like, you know, I've had the wonderful opportunity over the last 25 or 30 years to record, play, write songs with some of my all-time heroes, like writing a song with Donovan, really. I got to, and Mellencamp told me when he was going to go out on tour with us, he says, and Dane, he's riding on your bus and you're in charge of him. He knew I was a big fan. He was just kind of saying, I wasn't really in charge, but he said, you take care, Donovan.
That's great.
So, you know, I got to take care. I got to hang out with the dude that wrote the soundtrack to my early years.
Mine too. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so like John Fogerty, we did a tour with him the next year, I think it was, or maybe it was the year before. I can't remember that exactly time frame, but every night he was the opening act, but he would come on and play Green River with us. So I bought that 45 when it first came out, you know, it was 68, I guess. Yeah. I was 8 years old. So here I am banging along with that. And John Sebastian last year, I contacted him about doing a version of Sitting in Limbo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I contacted him about doing Sitting in Limbo, which was a song that he had covered on his Tarzana Kid record in 73. And I had done at the same tempo, but a rock beat behind it. And I just on a whim went to johnsebastian.com and found his manager's number and sent him an email and told him who I was. 15 minutes later, I had an email back from John himself saying, wow, I would love to blow the dust off that tune. Here's my home phone. Here's my cell phone. And just to get to talk to him, work with him. And we had many conversations that were an hour long. You know, he just would start talking about the past, and he knew I was I knew my Spoonful history. And but getting to hang out with him, you know, John Prine, I got to work with John, was a wonderful moment in my early career, about 1990, I guess it was. He came in and recorded. He said, this is the song I want to do. And I remember being in the control room, and he played a song called All the Best. And John Mellencamp said, well, why don't you just go out and you sing it and play it, and then we'll add the band after on top of that. So he went out. We didn't have a click track or anything. He just went out and played the tune perfectly, sang it wonderfully. And myself, Larry Crane, Toby Myers, and I think John Casella was playing accordion on it too. We went out and cut that track in one take live after that. And I love that version. Oh, the version that most people know came out on The Missing Years. But the version on the soundtrack is much more organic and cool. The other version has like a drum machine on it or something. But
right.
Anyway, that was quite a moment. And the coolest thing about this was I hung out with John later. We were at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. And one of my favorite nights that I've ever spent hanging out. And I was still smoking cigarettes at the time. And we were actually leaning up against a cigarette machine. That'll tell you how long ago it was. 1990. And we were both drinking a beer. I think we both had a cigarette, and we were just kind of hanging and checking it out. And he said, man, I really love what you did on that song, man. That was so cool. And, you know, he just kept talking about it, and he's just a nice dude.
Yeah.
When you run into those guys, I mean, not everybody that was one of your heroes or one of your idols, not all of them end up you don't have a conversation with them like that, you know, and sometimes maybe they had a bad day or whatever, but then there's times when, you know, this guy, anytime I was around him, he was always the same. He was genuinely nice.
You know who is the same personality from members of bands that are super groups, you know, like Aerosmith. I found Steve Tyler to be the same way. Eminently approachable, long conversations on the phone, met him in Boston at the rehearsal studio. Really, really a super nice guy. You know, he's not full of himself. I need to talk about this just because it occurred to me. My early days in 1970, and when I came back from England, I was still pretty keen on music, and I didn't really have anybody to jam with, and I'd never really jammed with anyone, but Marvin Dolgay, whose brother-in-law was Trevor Veach, and Trevor Veach used to play guitar with Tom Rush, and they were all hanging out in that part of the world that is now kind of, you know, where Todd Rundgren and the band, you know, New York State. And I realize now, and looking back, that a neighbor of his and a friend of his in his early musical years, who was born in Toronto, was Zal Yanofsky. And I have, with Marvin and Zal, And Val, who also went on to become president of Atlantic Records, all these people were just friends of mine back in the 70s, not having a clue that it would all kind of mushroom into these different.
So you knew Zolly from the
Spoonful? Not well. He came into the basement because Tom was in town, and Trevor Veach, who was Marvin's brother-in-law, came over. So, okay. And Trevor would jam with Garth and all those people from the band because he was in that scene. So, for me to be in a basement with an upright piano and a pump organ and just jamming and sort of finding my way, because I'd already been a kind of a I wasn't all conservatory music. I was already emulating Elton John, and I was already very keen on learning pieces that mattered to me. When I heard that piano solo in Lovely Rita, I had to learn it. So I did. And I had the chops to do that sort of thing. And I discovered that being amongst other musicians and having that organic, I was very naive to it, and I was very new to it, but it really spoke to me though. And you all probably remember that moment when, what it felt like. 'Cause I already played drums with, other musicians, the former band called Bear Mother, which morphed into Tom Cochran's band, Red Rider. I worked with those guys.
We toured with Tom Cochran in 2007.
Kenny Greer, their remarkable guitarist and pedal steel player, and very inventive guy. He and I were very close musical friends too, and we would rehearse in his basement and did a lot of blues, did a lot of just jamming. But at the time, I was a drummer, and then only when we went upstairs did we start to listen carefully to songs that we both enjoyed. And we would I think Abbey Road had just come out at the time, so we had to both kind of dive into the piano parts on that, So yeah, it was, but knowing that this world is so small that you would be working with John, and I had actually met Zal, and
it's amazing how small it is when it comes to stuff like that. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're young and starting out playing your instruments too, it's like, I started on piano. So the first cool song that I learned how to play was Michelle.
Oh yeah.
The Beatles. It was like, I was in third grade, but it was like a big note version of it. And I can still sit and play that. If I haven't done it for 5 years, I'll go, it's amazing how muscle memory will stick with you. I mean, literally, 50 years, 55 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's taking the initiative and then I started figuring out myself, once I'd learned the chords and stuff, how to move around in the key of C, I was learning how to play. I could play Let It Be almost like the record just by kind of hearing it. It's not very hard.
It is in the key of C too.
Oh, I know it is. That's what made it so easy, Yeah. But it's, you learn that. And I remember the first thing on the drums that I really tried to learn like the record was the first song on Led Zeppelin I, Good Times Bad.
Oh my God.
To learn that bass drum part.
Oh my God.
And that everything that you learn when you're first starting out influences you as you go through.
Oh, absolutely. I had to un-Elton my approach to piano after I kind of got so. And Leon, Elton Leon and Mac Rabinick also.
Why would you want to undo those guys? Those are the guys.
Well, no, it's good. It's good to have it. But I found myself sort of leaning. I loved big piano songs. Even to this day, if I started on piano, I'm very aware of the fact that this is becoming a fucking piano song. And then I'll slowly weed things out or mix them back and then bring other elements into the foreground. So it doesn't feel like, an Elton song or a Let It Be kind of piano song. It's very, very seductive when you're playing piano to play the instrument because it's so grand, no pun intended. It's such a lovely, all-inclusive, it's laid out in front of you, and how you play it and how it sort of supports the song isn't necessarily the best way for the song to end up, is what I'm saying.
Mm. Sure.
Yeah.
A lot of things I'll write on piano and I'll go, it just sounds like another piano ballad with a lot of chords.
Yeah.
Let me try to figure out how to, or get my guitar player, Eric Skull, I'll say, man, figure out how to play this like Julia.
Yeah.
Just to take it in a different direction, get it away from that. 'Cause I'll always tend to do the same thing.
And one of my favorite observations about that migration from the basement tape to the finish is Strawberry Fields. If you listen to the anthology, the scrubby little acoustic version that they first sort of played of that, I thought, yeah, that song's going nowhere. My first thought was, if I heard that, I wouldn't have the vision that George Martin and those boys had at the time, you know, to take it to that extraordinary space that it ended up in. You know, it was light years from the original. And that, you know, that's, like we were saying earlier, that the arrangements, I don't think it salvaged the song. It just gave the song.
No, it was a brilliant song. It turned into something that, like, the world had never heard before.
That's it.
That's what was amazing about it.
Well, on that trajectory of Small World, I'm pretty sure I talked about this, but I referred to drumming earlier, and I did love drumming. I never tried Bonham. I sort of fell away from drumming. I was more in the Dave Clark Five, you know, Ringo Starr, Charlie Watts. You know, I like pocket drumming, and I got Neil Peart, and I happened to meet the guy a couple of times in my career, bless his heart. And I got that kind of drumming and admired it immensely, you know. But as soon as Ginger Baker came on the scene and so on, I thought, yeah, I'm not good enough. So I delved more into piano and guitar at the time. But if I had known, I got a call from Terry Brown, who I still consider Rush's best producer to this day. And I think I've told you this story before, but again, Small World, I got a call asking if I'd like to do some arranging, some strings and some acoustic gut string guitar and so on. And I ended up putting Boys Choir and a whole bunch of other stuff on it. But he cleverly didn't tell me who I was working with. He just said it was a singer-songwriter who lived in the south of France, who we later interviewed. So, you know, the very fact that that he didn't tell me that we were working, or that we were working with a noted drummer from the Yardbirds.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And oddly enough, almost everybody you've mentioned, I could have segued when you talk about Steve Tyler. I said, yeah, I hung out with Steve all day one time at the TRC Studios, which is now Static Shack. Yeah. They were there.
Where is that?
It's in Indianapolis.
Okay.
It was in 87. It was right after Permanent Vacation. They were mixing a live thing in there that day. And they had just gone through rehab. They were drinking coffee like it was going out of style. Yeah. I mean, they were pounding. Joe Perry and Steve Tyler were both super nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's been fun this first year. I look forward to season 2.
It has been.
And, we got a lot of great people we've already talked to, obviously, and we'll get a bunch more.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I found this whole experience to be both educational and a privilege, you know?
Yeah,
great.
Absolutely. Just the same.
Chat with you fellas.
Likewise.
Peace, guys. I got to go.
Yep.
Dinner soon, okay?
Yep. Right. Yep, we'll do it.
See you guys.
Okay, bye.
Take care.
Bye.
See you, fellas.
You got it.